Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Last week, I interviewed Stephen Levitsky, a professor at Harvard University, who co-wrote Tyranny of the Minority. It is such an important book about the current state of American democracy and how to resuscitate it that I asked Professor Levitsky to continue our conversation into this week's Reader's Corner presentation. So for the second part of our interview about your book, Tyranny of the Minority, let's pick up on a topic you mentioned at the close of last week, counter-majoritarianism. I wonder, maybe this is a moment where I think you can help our listeners really understand the implications of the title of your book alone, Tyranny of the Minority, that majorities are not currently ruling America. And I think that's the scariest part of all. I know what we're going to do here in this section of the interview is talk about the pillars of minority rule. From last week, you mentioned the Supreme Court. I assume where you're going with this is this idea of term limits. Perhaps we could begin by your helping our listeners understand the original creation of the Supreme Court. What times were those? How different was it? How long did somebody live in those days? And what do we have today?
Well, in general, I think it's important to point out a couple of things about the U.S. Constitution and our institutions. First of all, it's very old. Our Constitution was designed in the 18th century during a pre-democratic era. Nobody in the West thought about the possibility of democracy as it currently exists in the world back in the 1780s. All of Europe was governed by monarchies. Democracy wasn't on the table at all. The idea that all citizens, all men, could vote was not really taken seriously among elites anywhere in the West. And so the U.S. Constitution, when it was created, the founders were in very much a new, uncharted territory. And they created what at the time was far and away the most progressive, democratic system on earth. It was really the first major non-monarchy in which governments were chosen at least by a segment of the population. And so we designed some pretty progressive institutions at the time, but the founders were trying to create a union of 13 very diverse states at a time when the Articles of Confederation had failed. Things were very unstable. There was fear of possible civil war, fear of a breakup of the Union, which might attract French or British intervention. The stakes were very, very high in the summer of 1787. And our founding leaders made a whole set of compromises, negotiated compromises, in some cases, improvisations aimed at getting something passed that would hold the Union together. And they did that. We can talk about the Senate and the Electoral College. But one of them was the Supreme Court, which at the time was not considered a very powerful body. Courts in Europe at the time were not independent of monarchies. It was not believed that people would want to spend their career on the Supreme Court, that they might stay for a few years and then go off and do something else, as several of our early justices did. And our justices didn't, frankly, live that long. The average lifespan was not what it was today. So the idea that you would nominate and appoint someone to the Supreme Court and that justice would stay on the court for 30 or 40 years, that was pretty much unthinkable. It was believed that they would not be on the court for that long. So there was no need for a retirement age and no need for term limits. It was believed that naturally people would be on the court for, I don't know, 8-10 years, and that would be it. But times change. People live longer. The Supreme Court grew over time in power and prestige. Now nobody leaves the Supreme Court to go off and start a business or run for Congress. People stay on the courts, and of course they live longer. So now we do routinely have justices who can and often do stay for more than a generation on the court.
So, Stephen, you mentioned the Electoral College. In your book, you refer to some pillars of minority rule, and that's certainly one of them. Between 1992 and 2020, how many times has the Republican Party lost the popular vote in presidential elections but was elected by the Electoral College vote?
Well, that has happened twice. So since 1988, to put it another way, in Taylor Swift's entire lifetime, the Republican Party has won the popular vote for president once. Since 1980, after 1980, since 1992, they've won the popular vote one time in 2004. And yet they have governed us for nearly half the 21st century, or for nearly half that period. So twice in the 21st century, the Republicans have lost the popular vote and yet won the presidency. That can happen in no other democracy in the world. In no other presidential system can the loser of the popular vote, the person who wins fewer votes, go on and become president. The U.S. is unique in that sense.
So how about the United States Senate in the 21st century? Have the Republicans serving in the United States Senate ever represented a majority of Americans?
No, not in the 21st century. So the Senate is skewed by the decision made in 1787 to give equal representation in the Senate to every state, no matter what the population. So the Senate, in an important sense, represents land, not people. Now, in a democracy, our leaders are supposed to represent people, not mountains, not trees, not farms, but people. But there was, and this is something that Madison and many other founders also believe. Hamilton, too. In fact, two of our most brilliant constitutional framers, Madison and Hamilton, opposed giving equal representation to each state, regardless of population. But the little state of Delaware, in alliance with New Jersey and a couple other small states, insisted on equal representation for each state and threatened to bolt the Constitutional Convention, potentially bringing the whole thing down, and in the minds of many framers, potentially threatening a collapse of civil war or military intervention, some kind of an alliance between defecting states and either Britain or France. So there were great fears for what would happen if Delaware and New Jersey bolted the convention in Philadelphia. So unhappily, in the case of Madison, they struck a deal. They conceded to the small states that each state would get equal representation in the Senate. That was unfair at the time because states like Pennsylvania and Virginia had much, much greater populations, something like 12 times as many people as Delaware, but it's gotten much worse over time. Now the population difference between California and Texas on the one hand and Vermont and Wyoming on the other hand is enormous. And so the U.S. Senate dramatically overrepresents sparsely populated territories. That was always undemocratic. It was always bad for California and always good for Wyoming. It never had partisan consequences, though, until the 21st century, because for most of U.S. history, both of the major parties had urban wings and rural wings. It's only in the 21st century that the Democrats became that our parties were divided along urban-rural lines. So the Democrats became the party of the cities, which makes them basically the party of the blue states, and the Republicans became the party that represented small towns and rural areas overwhelmingly. And so that urban-rural divide created a bias in the Senate towards the Republicans. This is not the Republicans' fault, but the Republicans now have a systematic advantage in the Senate. So we elect one-third of the Senate each every 2 years, right? Senators have staggered six-year terms, and one-third of the Senate gets elected every 2 years. So it takes 6 years to fully renovate the Senate. If you look at every six-year cycle since 2000, in the entire 21st century, every six-year cycle, the Democrats have won more votes than the Republicans. The Democrats have won the popular vote in every six-year cycle since 2000. And yet the Republicans have controlled the Senate for about half the time. Again, that is minority rule. So very quickly, think about 2016. In 2016, the party that won fewer votes for the presidency won the presidency. the party that won fewer votes for the Senate won control of the Senate. The Republicans lost the popular vote for Senate, but won control of the Senate. That president and that Senate went on to appoint and approve three justices on the Supreme Court, dramatically shifting that court and moving it to the right. So you had a president elected via minority rule, a Senate elected by a minority rule, transforming in a powerful way the Supreme Court, which is why we've been drifting since 2016 into a feeling in which majorities are profoundly unrepresented by our electoral system. We are drifting into minority rule.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephen Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Now, obviously, when it comes to the United States Senate, we don't have to worry about what you call geographic sorting. But I want you to touch on this because my own personal opinion is that the Democratic Party just got outfoxed on this one. There was a group of Republicans who got together at some point, I think you deal with this in the book, where they said, if we're going to control even Congress, the United States House of Representatives, then we have to control the districts. We have to write the districts. And gerrymandering, I think most people know what gerrymandering is, and it's supposed to be disallowed, but geographic sorting, it's going on everywhere, isn't it?
Geographic sorting is going on everywhere, and it's going on outside the United States as well. In just about every country in the West, I said earlier that about 20 or 30% of voters throughout Western democracies are voting for far-right parties. It's a very, very similar dynamic in which the cities are turning increasingly, I wouldn't necessarily say left, but becoming more cosmopolitan. People who live in the cities are more secular, more likely to be educated, more tolerant of diversity. I guess those are probably the main ones. And whereas people living in smaller towns, the countryside, tend to be more anti-immigrant, more religious, more resistant to cultural changes, and less cosmopolitan. And so that divide is happening everywhere. And that geographic sorting, as you put it, is happening everywhere. It's really, I think, problematic for the quality of democracy in many, many ways, but we tend increasingly to live near people who share our political views. That makes gerrymandering easier. So as you noted, gerrymandering has always been part of the U.S. tradition. It's not a very democratic thing. It doesn't happen in most other democracies. It's really crazy that elected officials should be able to carve out the districts in ways that benefit them. That's just not fair. It's not politically neutral. And it's not very democratic. It has always existed. It's always been done in the United States. It's kind of been done on steroids in the 21st century for a couple of reasons. I mean, it was done by both parties, and it was always tolerated because both parties, basically everybody, did it. But in the 21st century, the technology got much better. We were just much, much better able to very precisely figure out the partisanship and where people live and where people of different parties live, so you can really redistrict with surgical precision. And secondly, the stakes are just much higher. The level of polarization is such that allowing the other party to win control of, say, the state legislature is a much, much bigger deal than it was in much of the 20th century. And so the stakes have just risen dramatically. And it is true that both parties continue to engage in gerrymandering, but a couple of things. There are some states like California and now Michigan where voters in some cases have decided to change systems and have an independent authority oversee redistricting, so not allow elected officials to draw the lines. And so those states have less gerrymandering. But also geographics, the nature of urban versus rural geographic sorting gives Republicans certain advantages in gerrymandering. I don't have time to elaborate, but there's an excellent book written by political scientist Jonathan Rodden called Why Cities Lose that shows why this combination or why geographic sorting benefits rural parties more than it does urban parties. And so it's been easier for Republicans to gerrymander in the 21st century than for Democrats, even though both parties still do it.
So use the example of abortion as the issue that so much divides America, but also shows how this change in the number of urbanites we have in America today and rural America's control of the U.S. Senate, for example, how that all plays out.
Well, abortion is it's an issue that divides Americans a lot. And it's a complicated issue because Americans are not quite as polarized as we sometimes say. A lot, the vast majority of Americans converge on the old Bill Clinton principle that abortion should be, I think he put it, legal, safe, and rare. Americans don't like abortion, but they don't want to ban abortion. And they don't like late-term abortions. There's less polarization than we sometimes say. That said, pretty solid majorities of Americans believe that abortion should be fundamentally available to women. Maybe not, you know, all the way to term, but that it should be available to women. So the Supreme Court's striking down of Roe v. Wade, which had become a really take, you know, there are all kinds of questions you can raise about that actual ruling in the early 1970s, but the legality of access to abortion was something that had become a taken for granted fact among Americans, and it was supported by pretty solid majorities of Americans. The Supreme Court, in a very, very counter-majoritarian act, knocked that down, which is allowing, in some cases, gerrymandered state legislatures to put in place or allow in place abortion restrictions that are opposed by majorities in their state. We see this in particularly in purple and red leaning states like Ohio. And there's a possibility, given if the Republicans win the trifecta, the so-called trifecta in 2024, which is a possibility, winning the presidency, the Senate, and the House, there is a possibility that you will see some sort of national abortion restriction passed. There will be pressure from the right to pass some kind of national abortion restrictions. And that, again, is something that is unthinkable if we had a system of majority rule, if electoral majorities had the power that they ought to have in the United States.
This is Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Levitsky, co-author of Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. The book offers important context for our volatile times and a framework for how to protect our democracy from an authoritarian backlash. Well, I want to talk about how we might get there. You have a chapter called Democratizing Democracy. At the very close of your book, you ask the question, are these reforms pie in the sky? And I have to admit that as I was approaching those solutions you had, I thought, yes, they are pie in the sky. Then I read the rest of your book and was reminded of a most important point you're making in the conclusion of the book, and that is that there's not a knight in shining armor that's going to descend upon America and make all these things happen. It's going to take all of us. It's going to take every American to get involved, to pay attention to what's going on, to speak up and speak out and be active in the civic dialogue of their communities. I'd like you to comment on that, first of all, and then maybe we can talk about some of the paths forward to democratizing our democracy.
Sure. One thing I think is important to point out, although constitutional reform and democratic reform is hard in the United States, it's hard to reform our constitution. We have a long tradition in this country, going back to the founding, of democratic reform, of working to make our system more democratic. Just weeks after the Constitutional Convention in 1787, George Washington wrote a letter to his nephew in which he described the Constitution as an imperfect document and one that would require future generations to reform and get right. And generations of Americans have done exactly that, beginning with the Bill of Rights just 2 years after the Constitution was passed, continuing with this gradual expansion of the suffrage in the early 19th century, the very important Reconstruction reforms in the 1860s and 70s, to the Progressive Era reforms where we began to directly elect the Senate and granted women the suffrage belatedly in the 1920s, to the Civil Rights Era in the 1950s and 60s, which were not constitutional reforms, but rather legal reforms. So we have for 200 years worked to make our system more democratic. And then in the 1970s, we just stopped. It's really only in the last 50 years or so, which is unfortunately all of our lifetimes at this point, that Americans just sort of stopped thinking about making our system more democratic. We stopped thinking about democratic reform. We kind of decided to freeze everything in place. And now, because for two generations since the 1970s, we haven't really thought about, discussed constitutional reform, it's sort of become a conventional wisdom that you can't do that. It's not done. We've lost that great American tradition of working to make our system more democratic. So what we're advocating really is for going back to an older tradition of democratic reform. And the first step, we think, is you got to get the conversation going. You cannot make reforms if it's not discussed, if it's not publicly debated, if nobody thinks it's possible. It becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that, well, it's never done, so we're not going to talk about it, and nobody talks about it, then you reinforce the idea that it's never done. That needs to stop. That we need to begin to have a public conversation about reforms, about the necessity of reforms, the desirability of reforms, the feasibility of reforms. And only then, when the moment arrives, will we begin to do it. People forget, for example, that we came really close to abolishing the Electoral College in 1969. In 1969, both political parties' leaders supported abolishing the Electoral College. President Nixon supported abolishing the Electoral College. The American Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO and the American Bar Association supported abolishing the Electoral College. The abolition of the Electoral College passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. It had a majority of senators behind it. 70% of Americans supported it, but it didn't get quite to the two-thirds of the votes in the Senate to pass. So we came inches away, not inches, we came close to reforming the Constitution, abolishing the Electoral College, and we failed. And so it's not accurate to think that this is something that Americans could never do or would never do. We came very, very close in 1969 and 1970. And I think we have to at least begin to talk about it, to discuss it, because our democracy is in serious danger. If we continue to elect presidents who lose the popular vote, if our political system continues to churn out judicial rulings and laws that are opposed by as much as two-thirds of Americans, our system is going to dramatically lose. It already is losing legitimacy. If you go back 50 years, the vast majority of Americans expressed confidence and satisfaction with our democracy. In the 21st century, that's no longer true. And it's especially not true among younger generations of Americans. And that's not surprising. Younger generations of Americans grew up like Taylor Swift, in a world in which the loser of the popular vote was now regularly winning power. And that doesn't feel very democratic. And if you grew up under that, you're not gonna have a lot of confidence in our system. So it's really urgent that we take this up.
I want to talk about term limits for the Supreme Court. You point out in your book that Chief Justice Roberts, early in his career, I think when he was working for the Bush administration, supported Reagan, term limits. Reagan. And you actually have his quote in the book about that. I don't know whether he still stands there today, but this is a pretty good example of an issue that isn't just about liberals wanting conservatives off the court. It wasn't too many years ago that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was criticized for staying way too long on the court and depriving Obama of an appointment. Now, that may not have worked out anyway, as it turns out. Another subject that our listeners can pick up in your book, but I wonder if you could comment on that idea and any others that you think are pressing.
Well, this is a term limits for Supreme Court justices, either probably 18-year term limits, possibly 12 years, are something that both parties can agree on. No, neither party would necessarily get a partisan advantage for establishing term limits. We're not talking about packing the court. We're just talking about establishing term limits. Again, like every other established democracy in the world. What that would do, in addition to preventing justices from getting too far, from drifting just too far away from public opinion, is it would lower the stakes of the appointment process. If you had regular rotation on and off the court, again, probably 18-year term limits, each president would get a set number of appointments. Every president would know that she or he would have two Supreme Court appointments during a term. And so you would not have the kind of extraordinary crisis that has emerged really now almost every time a seat becomes available. The pressure to maybe hold out and not, if the opposition party controls the Senate, to do what Mitch McConnell did after Scalia's death and not fill a Supreme Court seat, that wouldn't be necessary. It would be a much more sort of low stakes, normal process of appointment. Every president gets two appointments per 4-year term. And that's really important because if you think back, going particularly back to the Merrick Garland case, really every one of our Supreme Court appointments has been either a full-blown crisis or a threatened crisis. It's a very, very high-stakes affair. And really, each one is threatening to throw us into some sort of an institutional or political crisis. And it's not how democratic politics should work. That's not how the Supreme Court appointment process should work. And so term limits would allow both parties to kind of step back, lower the heat, and sort of renormalize the appointment process.
You know, Steve, as I listen to you talk about the possibility of these reforms and read the conclusion of your book, I'm impressed with how you have identified from past periods of reform the fact that we're probably not going to get this done by a knight in shining armor. It's going to take all of us. And I want to be able to highlight, or have you highlight, the work of Cindy Wilson. We're talking here in Idaho, and here's a local example of somebody who moved beyond talking about reform and actually engaged citizens, and she makes it into your book.
Cindy Wilson is from an organization, an Idaho-based organization called Mormon Women for Ethical Government. And we included that example in the book because we think it's really important to point out, to reinforce the point that saving our democracy and eventually reforming and improving our democracy has never been and should never be a partisan affair. This is something that preserving our democratic system is important, valuable to all Americans, or for Americans from across the ideological spectrum. And so in our book, we point to a number of progressive or left of center groups that have been that emerged during the Trump period to defend democracy. But we also point to a pretty robust list of conservative groups that have emerged to both at the national level and at the grassroots level, including in Idaho, to defend democracy and to defend democratic values. And if we're going to get through 2024, if we're going to prevent the return of an openly authoritarian figure to the White House, which is a real risk today, it's going to take a very broad coalition of Americans, not just blue state Americans, not just activists in Massachusetts and California, but rather a very broad coalition of Americans that includes both young and old, that includes blue states and red states, that includes labor unions and business figures, that includes secular folks and religious folks. The coalition has to expand much, much beyond the sort of traditional large D Democratic Party or blue state coalition. It's got to be a very, very broad coalition. That's why I think the importance of at the grassroots level of the work of people like Cindy Wilson, but also at the national level, figures like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who have stood up for democracy and have been willing to join forces with people they don't agree with on a whole bunch of issues in order to defend our Constitution and our democratic rights.
A fitting conclusion to the book Tyranny of the Minority by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablatt. Thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
And a quick note, the Frank Church Institute is hosting author Betsy Gaines Quammen at the Boise State Special Event Center this coming Wednesday, April 10th, 5 to 8 p.m. The author, Betsy Gaines Quammen, will be discussing her new book, True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. It sure sounds like those of us living in the West will enjoy that one. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wing. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.